Hey, folks.
Oh, that's weird.
Hey, folks. Memorial Day is coming up. It is the unofficial start of summer. When is the official start of summer? I don't know. It doesn't matter. As far as I'm concerned, it's the start of summer. Although today it's 93 degrees and we don't have an air conditioner in here.
Yay!
Here's the point. Memorial Day is right around the corner, and that means summer travel season. And for people who have friends, wedding season. I've been to like one wedding in my entire life, I think.
And was it mine?
Two, three, actually, now three. Whether you rely on Sebadeh for sharper focus when vacation planning, better sleep when on the road, or easing general travel anxieties, now is a great time to stock up on Sebadeh tinctures. Starting today, you can get 35% off your favorite Sebadeh oil tinctures with the coupon code Memorial26. That's Memorial26. I will tell you right now, the pet tincture, awesome. For your pets, not for your people. And the good night oil. Those two are my go-tos. And then, actually, what's the matter?
Brian's chair is so loud. It's unbelievable. I
had to switch chairs.
See, sorry. Now a couple of shots of some Sebadeh tincture, just the normal stuff, and maybe you'd have a little bit less anxiety about that.
Yes.
I didn't hear it at all. Don't miss out. Sunset Lake Sebadeh tincture sale ends on May 26th at 11:59 p.m. 35% off with the coupon code Memorial26. Remember, you're buying direct from the farmers. With Sebadeh that has been grown without any pesticides. Check them out. See their site for terms and conditions. We'll, of course, put a link in the podcast and YouTube description. And now time for the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, May 19th, 2026. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Adam Serwer, author and staff writer at the Atlantic Magazine, on the total assault on voting rights in this country. Also on the program today, Taco Tuesday. Trump postpones today's planned attack on Iran.
No.
We'll see. I decided to temporarily postpone. U.S. grants another sanction waiver to Russia for oil sales as the world gets dangerously close to expending its total oil reserves. DOJ sets up that $1.776 billion slush fund for Trump, causing the top lawyer at Treasury to resign. Long Island Railroad reaches a deal with its union. The strike on the largest commuter rail in the U.S. ends with a union victory. Report: more than 100,000 American children have had a parent detained by ICE. Trump looking to admit 10,000 more. This is a great story of America opening its arms to refugees. Incidentally, Trump looking to admit 10,000 more white South Africans as refugees. Trump demands John Thune fires the parliamentarian after her ruling that the ballroom funding is not fit for the reconciliation bill. It's primary day in Alabama, in Georgia, in Idaho, in Kentucky, Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party in the street campaign in Pennsylvania's 3rd congressional district send illegal anonymous texts in an attempt to defeat Chris Robb. Get out there and vote for him today in Pennsylvania's 3rd CD. Speaking of polling, new polling is very bad news for Republicans. Meanwhile, the EPA is looking to rescind limits on 4 different forever chemicals in your water. Let's reintroduce those guys.
Oh, God.
2 teenage gunmen kill 3 at a San Diego mosque, then themselves. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is
Newsday Tuesday.
You're already starting laughing. What's going on?
Nothing is going on. I'm excited to be talking to you.
We're not on the same screen together. Are we? Oh, I don't see it.
Oh, we don't see the internal camera right now.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with that. Matt's out sick today. But Brian's back after his illness.
Caused by me, most likely.
Yeah,
yes.
I'm all hopped up on coffee and Dayquil and Matt not being here. So my heart rate's about 640 right now.
All right.
I'm trying to figure out how to fix this internal camera-ish.
We work on that. That's fine. We're all here. So it's, I think as long as it's getting out there, it's not an absolute tragedy. A lot to get to in the news today. We've been covering this potential for Donald Trump's slush fund for days now. And as I reported yesterday, Trump withdrew his suit a day or two before there was a deadline for the parties to justify this suit. And by withdrawing the suit, essentially took the authority to oversee any type of deal out of the hands of the court. And the DOJ has the authority to settle potential suits before they go to trial. Of course, we want that ability. This is just a clear abuse of that that power. And it is unclear who has standing to sue against it. Congress could pass a law. That's probably not going to happen. But this slush fund has absolutely no guardrails. It is just a total giveaway. It is very much like what Jimmy Hoffa would have done back in the day. Or, it's sort of what Trump's been doing with just tax dollars when it comes to I'm going to give my pool guy a huge contract to paint the reflecting pool. And then for the rest of Mar-a-Lago's days, there won't be any charges. Who knows?
Well, it looks also like he's going to be forced to drop his BS $10 billion lawsuit against the IRS, which is essentially
him. Point.
Right, right. And so the Treasury Department slush fund thing, though, I do think that it's even bigger than that. It's as corrupt as we're talking about. But he's also trying to send a message where if you break the law on my behalf, from the brown shirts on January 6th to the corrupt billionaire oligarchs who have funded my campaign, you'll be rewarded as long as I'm in power. So you better keep me in power.
I wouldn't necessarily assume that he's going to pay out that money to anybody based on any other.
But that's the message he's sending. And he's been consistent with that throughout his presidency.
It's a mob situation. Understand that. $10 billion lawsuit against the IRS, it's clear now, was always just a scam. It was to build a predicate as to why there needed to be a settlement. It was never intended to actually go to court, and that's where this settlement derives from. Here is ABC News reporting on Trump's DOJ-affirmed $1.7 billion slush fund.
This morning, a potentially unprecedented settlement between President Trump and the government he runs.
Sources tell ABC News the president is expected to drop his $10 billion lawsuit against the IRS in exchange for potential financial compensation for allies that claim they were wrongfully targeted by the Biden administration. The deal, which sources caution is not finalized, would use taxpayer dollars to establish a $1.7 billion fund used to settle claims brought by anyone who alleges they were harmed by the Biden administration's so-called weaponization of the legal system. Sources say one group that would be eligible to tap into that are the nearly 1,600 people charged after the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Pause
this
it for
comes
one second.
As President
you
Trump
know who else, based upon this vague notion of who was hurt by the Biden administration lawfare, is Donald Trump.
That's such a weird coincidence.
It is shocking. In fact, there's no one in Trump's orbit who couldn't make an argument. And here's the thing, is that based upon the original outlines of the settlement, all we have now is a two-page reference to the settlement agreement that it established a fund. But according to documents that were reported on in the past, Blanche will appoint these people, but Trump can fire them at will, presumably reappoint them. And there is no questioning of who they give the money to. There is no requirement they release names of people they've given money to, or in what amounts, or for what reason. But continue.
Attack on the Capitol. This comes as President Trump is suing the Treasury Department and the IRS for $10 billion in damages over the leak of his tax returns during his first term in office. And after sources told ABC News he was pressing his Justice Department to pay roughly $230 million for the investigations he faced during the Biden administration.
It's interesting because I'm the one that makes the decision, right? And, you know, that decision would have to go across my desk. And it's awfully strange to make a decision where I'm paying myself.
According to sources,
awfully
the commission
strange.
That would oversee the fund would have total authority on who they hand the money out to, which could amount to an unparalleled use of taxpayer dollars with little oversight. Sources say the president would have the authority to remove members of the commission without cause, and that the commission would not be required to disclose how it runs or its decision-making process. The proposed fund, which could face legal hurdles, would draw its money from a Treasury Department judgment fund, a permanent bucket of federal dollars used to pay court judgments and settlements, sources said. The settlement terms are expected to bar the president from directly receiving payments related to the claims of his lawsuits.
Oh, yes,
but it does not
me.
Explicitly prohibit entities associated with him from doing so. And this morning, Democrats slamming the potential settlement. Senator Elizabeth Warren calling it an insane level of corruption and dubbing it a slush fund for Trump's handpicked stooges to hand money to January 6th insurrectionists and his political allies. And former FBI Director James Comey.
We don't need to hear more of this. I mean, the money is going to go to Trump. I imagine the J6 people will get a little cash bonus. But let's be clear. This is Donald Trump's slush fund. He might as well have this money in his pocket. Let's play this clip that Emma just did.
We're in the middle right now of these hearings in the Senate for Todd Blanche, who is currently acting attorney general. And he and Van Hollen have been going at it all day. Van Hollen, one of our better senators. And it appears like, based on the all caps that I'm seeing that Asin captioned this, a great account that people should follow, holding the Trump administration accountable, that Blanche maybe got a little testy and lost it.
You're not going to submit this proposal to any federal judge or independent.
There is no judge.
Any independent authority?
What does that mean, an independent authority?
It means not somebody who's getting to pick five of the members who was the president's former personal attorney. That would be somebody who would be independent.
I'm the acting attorney general, okay? And the fact that I used to be President Trump's lawyer is just a fact, but I'm the acting attorney general. So don't say the president's former personal lawyer will do something. The acting attorney general will do something.
Mr. Attorney General, you are acting today like the president's personal attorney, and that's the whole problem. You've got you have a whole banner of his face hanging over the Department of Justice, and you and everybody else walks under it, and you are acting like you're his current personal attorney. Mr. Chairman, I have no further questions.
I want to also remind people, and I think Van Hollen should have brought this up. Todd Blanche was specifically told by the DOJ's ethics advisor, lawyer, internal system that you are to recuse yourself on every case that has to do with Donald Trump. He did not do that before he was acting attorney general, and he's not doing it now that he is acting attorney general. The idea that the former defense attorney for Donald Trump is now deciding whether to give Donald Trump control over $1.7 billion. Doesn't have to go into Donald Trump's pocket. If somebody gives me $1.7 billion and says, you know, pay your employees, well, I got news for you. I pay the employees. But guess where the money that would normally go to paying the employees goes? Into my pocket. Right. I mean, it's just such an incredible joke.
And I mean, the settlement stuff, it's supposed to be after these cases are litigated.
I bet you. Well, not necessarily. No, you have settlements. I mean, this is the thing.
Right. But if you come to a determination.
The only thing that is the only way to stop this is for Congress to pass.
Yes.
And it should be brought up. The Democrats should be bringing up a bill over and over and over again, because I don't know that there's anybody who has standing to sue against this. Certainly, this is a practice that happens. The DOJ will settle usually it's under the auspices of the court, but sometimes they'll settle just because it's not worth taking it to court. This is obviously a complete bastardization of that. But it's conceivable that if Donald Trump still owes Todd Blanche money from defending him against his charges that were associated with the Biden era, that money could go into this fund and then get paid to Todd Blanche.
I mean, that's probably why it hits a little bit of a nerve when Van Hollen brings up how close he is to Trump in that way. I mean, it's so nakedly corrupt. At another point in that exchange, like there, that we'll play it later, but Ghislaine Maxwell comes up. Do we remember what happened with Ghislaine Maxwell?
We'll see if she gets her pardon. All right. Well, in a moment, we're going to be talking to Adam Serwer, author and staff writer at The Atlantic. But first, a word from our sponsor. We'll have a lot more to say about that slush fund. This episode of Majority Report brought to you by Wild Grain. Wild Grain is the first bake from frozen subscription box for artisanal breads, seasonal pastries, and fresh pastas. Literally, when I read those words, I am thinking about the smell in my apartment this weekend when I made Saul his croissant.
They're so good, those croissants.
It is amazing what the smell of fresh baked bread does to your just whole demeanor.
Didn't you try to bring him one to his bedroom and ate it before you got to the...
That happened the first time.
Yeah.
I'm trying
to... You don't
live
in a Hamptons estate, do you?
No, it's literally like 12 feet. I was like, literally, I came in with crumbs in my beard. And I'm like, buddy, I got some bad news. I got some good news and some bad news. The good news is I figured out how to really bake them well. The bad news is I'm going to make you another one. The thing with this, though, is that not only do you get that smell, it is incredibly easy. Wild Grain is the first bake from frozen subscription box. Did I say this already? For artisanal breads, seasonal pastries, and fresh pastas. I did. Unlike many store-bought options, Wild Grain uses simple ingredients you can pronounce and a slow fermentation process that can be easier on your belly and richer in nutrients and antioxidants. There's no preservatives. There's no shortcuts. Plus, all items conveniently bake in 25 minutes or less. No thawing required. This is so easy. I made them chocolate chip cookies the other night. 16 to 20 minutes. I've already memorized this. 375 degrees. You got to preheat the oven. You put one of these frozen cookies on I use parchment paper, or you put it right on the baking pan. And the whole house smells like chocolate chip cookies. They're delicious. Honestly, it couldn't be easier. It couldn't be more tasty. But they have things like ham and cheese croissants, chocolate croissant. full loaves of bread, sourdough bread, biscuits. They've got pasta. I mean, all of it is fantastic. Imagine having fresh bakery quality bread, pastries, and pasta at home without any trips to the store. And don't just take my word for it. They have over 40,000 five-star reviews and have been voted best food subscription box by USA Today for 3 years in a row. For a limited time, Wild Grain offering you $30 off your first box. Plus, you ready for this? Free croissant for life. When you go to wildgrain.com/majority to start your subscription today, that's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life when you visit wildgrain.com/majority. Or you can use the promo code majority at checkout. We'll put the description in the, or the link, I should say, in the podcast and YouTube description and at majority.fm. We got a quick break. And when we come back, Adam Serwer, author and staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Pleasure to welcome back to the program Adam Serwer, author, staff writer at The Atlantic. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
I have been, on one hand, very surprised at how little attention, relatively speaking, the Calais ruling has gotten and the implications of it. On one hand, surprised. On the other hand, this has been sort of like telegraphed by the Supreme Court for over a decade. Let's go back, though, before we get there. Will you walk us through a little bit the sort of reconstruction roots of what we're seeing today? And you write in your piece about the 15th Amendment and how it's being how the interpretation of the 15th Amendment by the Supreme Court today is completely wrong based upon how it was created.
Well, it's really an inversion of what the amendment was supposed to do. You know, at the time, you know, the South is, black people in the South are being terrorized by racist Democrats. Democrats are making some headway arguing against black suffrage in the North. So the idea is to solve the problem by simply enfranchising everybody everywhere by, you know, by making sure that you cannot deny the right to vote on the basis of race. Now, the radicals at the time had critiques of the 15th Amendment because they feared it was not broad enough. And they correctly perceived that there were loopholes in the amendment that reactionaries would use to disenfranchise the very people they were trying to protect. And that's unfortunately what happened. So after Reconstruction, the Supreme Court, which is made up of largely Republican appointees, some Union veterans even, basically says as long as, you know, the disenfranchisement devices are not explicitly racial, they're constitutional. So that's how you end up with these sort of superficially race neutral laws that the purpose of which are to disenfranchise black people. You know, grandfather clauses, literacy tests, poll taxes, stuff like that. The explicit purpose is to get around the 15th Amendment prohibition so that you can disenfranchise black people. And now, it ends up disenfranchising some poor whites as well. But, you know, the purpose is to reestablish white supremacy in a way that will pass legal muster. And the post-Reconstruction court essentially allows this, interpreting the Civil War amendments in as narrow a way as possible.
And this is because, we should say, the 15th Amendment says it establishes the right to vote can't be denied on account of race, color, or previous conditions of servitude, and then grants Congress power to enforce through legislation. But the explicit idea of the 15th Amendment is to enfranchise black people. In other words, that it was racial in its intent.
It was racial and partisan. And, you know, there were people who objected.
And explain how it was partisan, too, because, you know, I'm not sure, like, people are fully aware of, like, sort of the dynamic. Democrats, sure, at that time, of course, more associated with the Confederacy, Republicans more associated with the Union, and they were the party of Lincoln at that time. And you knew that Lincoln was a Republican, right?
To clarify, like, there's almost nobody at this time who you would recognize as, like, you know, a modern liberal. Right. You'd have to go to someone like Charles Sumner or Thaddeus Stevens to get someone who, like, even approaches sort of that combination of economic and social liberalism. But so at the time, you know, the Republican Party is the party of the Union, and they realized that, you know, their political project is not viable without black suffrage in the South. And so a lot of guys who are pretty conservative go along with the Civil War amendments, not just abolishing slavery, but the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment, precisely because they understand that the Republican Party, if it's going to have voters in the South at this point, it's going to be black people and, like, maybe some white people, but mostly black people. And they also understand that, you know, up north, it's not the most popular idea. So the easiest way to ensure that, you know, black suffrage is placed beyond sort of political machination is to amend the Constitution in order to make sure that black people can't be denied the vote on the basis of race. And there are some nativist Republicans at this time who are like, well, you're going to give, you know, Chinese people the right to vote. And, you know, the radicals are like, yeah, that's exactly what we're doing. It doesn't matter. Everybody, you know, people like Representative John Bingham are saying, you know, we are going to rid the country of the horrid blasphemy that this is a white man's country. And of course, at the time, the Democrats, you know, they're essentially running on white supremacy explicitly. You know, this is a white man's country, let white men rule. And so, you know, the 15th Amendment is adopted at a time of vicious, you know, racially motivated partisan disenfranchisement. Black people in the South are dealing with terrorism and violence from the Ku Klux Klan. You know, they're dealing with a Democratic Party that is explicitly stating its mission is to reassert white supremacy. And so if the 15th Amendment didn't bar you know, partisan motivated racist disenfranchisement, it wouldn't have done anything at all. So it doesn't make any sense to say, well, you can't disentangle race and party. And therefore, you know, we just sort of have to let these racist restrictions go through. The Republican Party, the cause of the 15th Amendment was a partisan cause. It was an ideological cause. It was a principled cause. You know, there these, you know, some of these guys in the, you know, the radicals like Charles Sumner and Thaddeus Stevens, Frederick Douglass, these people obviously are expressing moral views about race that we would recognize as very enlightened. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they also understood that the Republican Party was the only vehicle for doing this because the Democratic Party at the time was an explicitly white supremacist organization. And, you know, the idea is just to say, you know, whether you're in the Republican Party, whether you're the Republican Party in the 21st century or the Democratic Party in the 19th century, the Constitution bars, you know, writing black people out of the Constitution so that you don't have to appeal to them at all.
It feels like the justification in the minds of, like, if you could just go back to what Scalia wrote in Shelby in 2013 and Alito's attitude today, that the idea is, well, they did it for partisan. They did it. The 15th Amendment was may have like sort of born out of a partisan sentiment that involved racial enfranchisement. So why can't we say it's okay for partisan sentiment that disenfranchises people? It's almost the same, except for, I mean, that's sort of what it is, right? I mean, they think, like, you did it to help win elections, so we can do it to help win elections, completely ignoring the idea that, well, there's also this other principle of, like, we have a democracy.
Yes. I mean, look, I think you can, you know, it starts earlier than Shelby County, right? So, you know, in the 1980s, you know, the Reagan administration is opposing a reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act because it adds an effects test to the Voting Rights Act that says any voting changes that have the purpose or effect of discriminating are illegal. And the reason why I did that was because there was a case that was involved, you know, that involved overt racial discrimination, or what was clearly racial discrimination, but you couldn't prove intent. And so in the end, what happened was that black people were being denied the right to vote, even if you didn't have like a smoking gun where someone's using the N-word or something.
Right. This is like de facto, it's like a de facto test.
Right. And so Roberts, you know, he's a young lawyer in the Justice Department, and he writes, you know, this is terrible. Like, this is a justification for the most intrusive interference imaginable. And so I think, you know, from an ideological point of view, Roberts has always seen efforts to alleviate racism as worse than racism itself, especially because, and you can see this every time they gut a piece of the Voting Rights Act, they congratulate themselves on how not racist the country is anymore.
Right.
But what we're seeing, you know, with Republican efforts to sort of redraw their districts to get rid of all their plurality minority or majority minority districts, is that the thing that was holding back explicit racism in the United States wasn't like sort of that we're so much better than our ancestors, but it was the explicit prohibitions on that kind of discrimination. And it just illustrates why it was so important. And, you know, at the time, Ruth Bader Ginsburg in Shelby County, she's like, it's like throwing away your umbrella when it stops raining because you're no longer getting wet. And, you know, obviously we still need the umbrella, and we always needed it. But they simply didn't care because from an ideological point of view, they saw, you know, this as a kind of unconstitutional federal government interference that was unjustifiable. And I think to some extent, it really goes back to the whole like states' rights issue. And again, this is, you know, I really do think that some of the justices on the court have this idea that the Civil War amendments to the Constitution are sort of illegitimate, and that they ruined the real antebellum Constitution that was written by the founders. And so as a result, these amendments need to be narrowed because they're simply too expansive. They give the federal government too much power to interfere in the authority of the states. And you could see this in the Shelby County ruling when, you know, John Roberts says that the Voting Rights Act as it was written interferes with the quote unquote equal sovereignty of the states, as though that's more important than people's constitutional right to vote. And I think, you know, for that reason, they've simply approached any like federal effort to deal with racism as morally equivalent to racism itself. And this is something that the professor Ian Haney Lopez calls, you know, reactionary colorblindness. So it's saying affirmative action is the same thing as Jim Crow.
I mean, this is just, but this ideology, when you distill it to that, I hadn't heard it described that way about those amendments and the illegitimacy of it. But it really does color, I think, the conservative ideology quite well and what this court represents, which is a court of Confederates. I think if we speak about it in those terms, it strips away a lot of the, I guess, highfalutin, fancy ways, the priest-like ways that these the justices believe that they, you know, that's how they operate. They are just trying to reify almost the Confederacy to a degree.
Well, look, I mean, again, you know, the Civil War amendments were explicitly meant to, you know, make sure that America was not a white man's government. That was their purpose. I know that sounds like quote unquote woke, but this is what the guys who wrote these amendments thought. They were trying to correct the original flaw of the Constitution, which was that it made it possible for there to be, you know, an overclass as a result of its implicit protections for slavery. And so, you know, in a way, it really is, you know, the historian Eric Foner calls the Civil War amendments and Reconstruction the second founding. And it really is the second founding, because it takes that first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence about, you know, everybody being created equal very seriously. And it tries to make that a reality. And immediately after, you know, within 10 years of those amendments being adopted, you know, a big chunk of the country says, well, we don't like that. We don't want that. We want an explicitly a country that is explicitly, you know, sort of class based and the class is based on race. And so, you know, unfortunately, this is just something that is a part of. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like it's inevitable, because I don't think it is. But it is something that's like very deeply rooted in our history. And it's something we've been battling, you know, since the founding of the country and arguably before.
I do think this is really just a battle as to what constitutes the founding of the country. And mm-hmm. I mean, the past 100 years plus at this point, 150 years nearly, have been. The overwhelming majority of our of like Supreme Court rulings, I think, are probably somewhere between the 13th, 14th, 15th amendments. What do you think it is? Are we just really just sort of like seeing the slow motion backlash from the Voting Rights Act in 65? Like the
yes.
Like, let me just add one thing. This is the thing, is that, you know, Johnson famously said, you know, we're going to lose the South for two generations. And I think he just like overestimated how quickly what had happened would filter through to the American people. I can't remember the name of the professor. I cite this all the time. We had him on years ago. But the most interesting statistic I've ever heard, I think, was that up until 2008, 50% of non-college educated white people thought the Republicans were to the left of Democrats on race. Up until Obama gets elected, there is still a massive cohort of people who think the Democratic Party is the Democratic Party from 150 years ago. And it's almost as if like it's just catching up now to where people are like, wait a second. When did black people get the right to vote? There's a certain cohort that the Republican Party has. It's almost caught up with them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the backlash to the Warren Court, and keep in mind, you know, we had a liberal court for like a couple years, and it completely, you know, it completely radicalized the conservative movement into like developing its own alternate legal movement for the
you
purpose.
You get the Powell Doctrine, you get the Federal, yeah. the Federal Society, you get the Heritage Foundation on it.
All that stuff. And, you know, National Review is publishing, you know, criticisms of Brown v. Board, criticisms of the Civil Rights Act, criticisms of the Voting Rights Act. You know, Barry Goldwater is, you know, objecting in a moral sense to racism, but also saying, you know, the federal government banning discrimination is like, you know, even worse. So, you know, this is like a core, I think, you know, is like really core to the 20th century modern conservative movement and the conservative legal movement in particular. And I think, you know, part of the issue here is that until I think it's really the reaction to Barack Obama that provides it with this sort of momentum, because then they can start saying, well, the racism issue is really solved now. We have a black president, you know, who we opposed tooth and nail, and we said is, you know, his health care bill was reparations or a civil rights bill, which is what Rush Limbaugh called it. You know, and they could say, well, you know, this racism problem has been solved. And I think to some extent, the reason
that's literally what Scalia said, incidentally.
Yeah, one of the attorneys who is the attorneys for Shelby County said it's an old disease and the disease has been cured, which is like an absurd thing to say. You know, especially like at that moment where there was like a racist backlash to the black president happening. But I think, you know, one of the things that happened was that there was this, you know, particularly in the Obama era, Obama had such a massive cultural impact on like public facing jobs. So in media and entertainment and particularly Congress got more diverse than it had ever been. You know, there was this. There was this integration of sort of elite America that occurred as a result of, you know, so the cultural currents that were swirling around Barack Obama. And that gave people the perception of a more integrated America that didn't really exist, because occupational segregation, for example, has not budged since the 90s. You know,
though Eric Holder was attorney right. general.
And, I mean, you had that. That was yes. real. Like, you know, you had black people in positions of leadership. You had like more black shows on television. You had more black actors being cast in movies and TV shows. Not like overwhelmingly, but there was like, you know, a significant change. And there was this sort of, you know, this incredible reactionary backlash to it. I mean, now whenever you see people complaining about like the Little Mermaid is black or something like that, right. It seems silly, but that kind of stuff is actually about labor. It's actually saying we don't think black people should have those jobs. And that's, you know, and now, you know, we're seeing something like that when it comes to Congress. Like, this decision is most likely going to result in fewer in a less diverse Congress, because 50% of the black American population lives in the South. So if Republican-controlled states can simply wipe out all their black districts, because technically it's partisan gerrymandering, not racial gerrymandering, it doesn't violate the 15th Amendment, then you're going to see, you know, a lot of black representatives lose their districts. Now, I don't know how that plays out in the long term. I think stuff like this is sometimes difficult to game out because, you know, again, like, who knew that Donald Trump was going to crack the blue wall in 2016? You know, I think that, you know, some people did. Some people anticipated that, but very few people, I think, really were anticipated it. I mean, things happen that we do not expect. So, right. you know, I don't necessarily know that this is going to go the way that they're planning for it to go, but it's certainly motivated by a feeling of being threatened by, you know, the rise of black people in elite places where, you know, these people feel like they don't really belong. I mean, you can see that now with the way Hegseth is running the military, with the way the Civil Rights Division is being run, you know, suing schools for having too many black students, like Yale Medical School for having too many. I mean, like, this is, you know, I think the Voting Rights Act is part of a broader agenda of elite resegregation. That is itself a backlash to, you know, not just Barack Obama, but the more diverse elite class that emerged as a result of his election.
Do you think I'm just curious about the idea of, because we spent a lot of time on this program in the wake of Trump and in 2016, and I want to say like a lot of time, as in like 4 or 5 years, talking about the sort of the notion of this racial backlash. And how much of that do you think was just a function of like they shouldn't have this job, that it was economic, as much as like you have some form of, and not necessarily, you know, across the board, but there was an animus about not being centered in the same way in culture.
Yeah. I think that's a big part of it.
I mean, my example is just like, you know, I'm turning on the TV and all of a sudden, like, why is this black guy on the Cialis commercial? That should be me. Mm-hmm. You know, who's getting that? Or, you know, because as a white kid, you're growing up in 1975, 1980, and literally everything you see, you are centered. It's either you as a dad, and it's either you in the future, or it's your future. It's your mom, or it's your future wife, or, you know, whether it's a commercial or a TV show, it's like almost all of them. And then all of a sudden that goes away.
I mean, you can see it right now with this whole stupid controversy over the Odyssey and like having black people in the Odyssey. Like, you know, it's simply the idea, you know, it is a sort of like reverse cultural appropriation discourse almost. Like, nobody's mad that Matt Damon is in Greek, but they're mad that Lupita Nyong'o is black. Right. And it's explicit racism. It's like, this is our stuff, this belongs to us, and you shouldn't be a part of it. And also, you know, it extends to, I mean, and I think the absurd thing about the Odyssey in particular is like, when you start talking about like Shakespeare or antiquity, like these are materials that have been put on by diverse casts for generations. They've all, you know, like Paul Robeson did Macbeth in Haiti. You know what I mean? Like, this is like a very old thing. This, you know, the idea that the Odyssey explicitly only belongs to like white guys who were born between 1960 and today is sort of absurd. But I do think there is, you know, again, I don't want to say that everybody who voted for Trump was motivated by that, but I do think that this ideological vanguard that surrounds Trump, when you look at their preoccupations and what they use as propaganda to sort of get people riled up and motivate people, it is this kind of like explicitly culture war stuff that has like a sort of serious economic undertone of like, black people shouldn't have those kinds of jobs. Black people shouldn't be in Congress. Black people shouldn't be in movies. Black people shouldn't be directing movies. They shouldn't be showrunners. They shouldn't be in writers' rooms. This kind of stuff, it seems silly, but then when you dig underneath, what we're really talking about is, you know, to some extent, economic segregation in elite professions.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it still rings in my head, and this isn't specifically about the white supremacy piece, but it feeds into it. Is when Trump won, there was some anonymous banker that gave a quote to the Financial Times about how we get to say the R word again. And, you know, that's about another marginalized community, but it's about a feeling of empowerment. And
they wanted to say, we are allowed to say the N word again.
Exactly.
But they just said R word. Right. It's like a limited hangout.
But that banker is maybe a little bit not the base of his support, although maybe the base of his financial support, but the people, the evangelical base, the base of Christian conservatives that was always there, and, you know, was Bush's base as well. That's why we shouldn't treat Trump as such an anomaly. Like, his blondness, his whiteness, and the kind of prosperity gospel that he embodies is very much, even if he's from New York, a like cultural product of the South, the Confederacy, and white supremacy.
I mean, if you look, I mean, the politics of, you know, if you go like sort of antebellum politics, the Democratic Party is very much about this idea of like equality between white men, you know, who are the head of their households. You know, you are in charge. You know, your wife and your slaves obey you. And this sort of elevates all white men, regardless of economic status, to, you know, a tier of status above everybody else. And when you look at sort of, again, it's not everybody. I think a lot of people, you know, sort of normal people with conservative views are put off by it. But when you look at sort of this ideological vanguard of the American right, they're really obsessed with this stuff, with this kind of nostalgia of, you know, this era when, you know, white men's, you know, enhanced status in American society was unquestioned. And that's not wholly an economic thing. But, you know, obviously there is sort of an economic base for it. I mean, it comes out of the culture of chattel slavery. But, you know, people, the way that economics interacts with people's ideological views is more complicated than a one-to-one. And I do think that, you know, as, you know, that banker who you were talking about, that guy is probably not suffering economically, but he was suffering from a sense that he wasn't allowed to denigrate the people who he considers beneath him without suffering some kind of social stigma. Yeah. And I think there are a lot of people who voted for that. I don't know that everybody did. I mean, you look at like the sort of broader economic trends across the world, you know, incumbent parties suffered similar setbacks as a result of, you know, the post-COVID inflation. But, you know, there were people who absolutely voted for Trump because they felt like he was going to bring, and you saw this immediately after he won, this sort of cultural vibe shift where it was kind of cool to be a racist asshole again.
Yes.
And, then, you know, that didn't pan out as, you know, in the way that they wanted it to.
As Elon Musk said, comedy is legal again. And so let's talk. I want to talk about sort of like the backlash to what we're seeing in both in terms of like, you know, what ultimately is going to be solutions are on the table. But I've seen I think I've read something to the effect that John Lewis, when it came to those rulings in the 80s, had some hesitation because there was a sense that it would undermine perhaps the white progressive, whatever you would have called it in that era, black progressive coalitions that would form. And I wonder if, like, what your thoughts are, both on the potential for that in the wake of this, but also, you know, as I read that in 2012, I think it was, I had Glenn Ford on, who was the late Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Report, mm-hmm. who was arguing to me that Obama was, in fact, the greater of two evils, and that the problem he had with Obama, or one of the large ones, was that Obama was undercutting the Black radical tradition. That and I think, you know, radicalism being on a spectrum in terms of like and I wonder if it was just Obama or if like the CBC, which is like surprisingly, I don't know what you want to call it, moderate, corporatist, establishment oriented, not radical, but not even on the spectrum towards radicalism in the way that we understand it today. I wonder if that's going to change the nature of Black representation of the CBC, or, you know, if there is like a situation where, you know, I think we could have surprises in the wake of this gerrymandering because of the nature of this cycle.
Right.
But I'm
so
talking.
I think the serious critique of the majority minority district stuff was that these districts allowed Republicans to keep their districts redder and to, you know, segregate off, you know, not in a racial sense, but to make blue districts in Republican states safe blue so that they can make the rest of the state red. And, you know, Democrats in those states were fine with it because then they had these safe seats that were sort of like fiefdoms that they could keep getting elected to. And I think that is the reason why, actually, that we don't know, you know, what the outcome of this is going to be in terms of, you know, I think Republicans think that this is going to lessen the power of Black voters. And as a result, there are going to be fewer. It will insulate them from the consequences of the Trump era politics they've embraced, which is one of like overt racial discrimination. I mean, I'm looking at, you know, I live in Texas here in San Antonio, and, you know, I'm looking at ads and it's like, you know, Chip Roy supports Sharia law. It's like really like lowest common denominator gutter racist stuff. And, you know, I'm not sure that that's going to work out precisely the way they want, because as long as black people can vote, people are going to try to get those votes, right? And so if in a close contest, you may find some Republican politicians thinking, well, maybe if I appeal to black voters, that'll give me an edge over my opponent, especially in states, you know, like Louisiana, like Mississippi, where those populations are, really are substantial. So, you know, I don't know what
So do you think that it could end up moderating the Republican Party in some fashion? I mean, one of the problems we have now is that...
I think that is a possible outcome. I think the problem with that possibility, or the thing that would, you know, that would prevent that possibility, is that if this snowballs further than it already has, because what happened, you know, after Reconstruction was that, you know, black people were not immediately completely disenfranchised. That, you know, that full disenfranchisement happens almost partially as a reaction to the coalitions that black people are making with working class white people and the populace. This really freaks the Democrats out. And they, you know, they go on like a total rampage campaign of terror that ends in like total black.
Literal. South Carolina, they're killing politicians because they're trying to get Appalachian, you know, the idea of like Appalachian whites, you know, more progressive and more populist, I should say, too, economically. Forming a coalition with blacks, they literally end up killing people in South Carolina and driving these politicians out of town.
It is an existential threat to the Democratic Party at that moment, and they respond to it, you know, with the tools that they and that the Democratic Party at the time is equipped with, which is violence and terrorism. And it works for a period of time, but I think again, there's a couple of things, you know. I don't think that they know what the long-term effects of this will be, both on either part, to be honest. You know, it's actually possible that the Democratic Party becomes more conservative as a result of, you know, it being, you know, of the influence of black voters being diminished in these areas. You know, that's what happened with the Republican Party when they, you know, no longer had a black constituency in the South to appeal to. But the other, you know, it really depends on like how much this snowballs. The disenfranchisement, the complete disenfranchisement of black people coincided with a campaign of terror and overt discrimination and the imposition of Jim Crow. So I think like we don't know how this is going to go. You know, I think it's unjustifiable, but I don't think it necessarily ends in a way that is like easily predictable over the long term. You know, in the short term, obviously, I think it results in, you know, a diminishing of black representation in Congress, which is the goal. But, you know, I just like the fact is that black people are never going to give up trying to be free and equal. That just, you know, that didn't happen, you know, after Reconstruction. It didn't happen with the campaigns of terrorism that followed Reconstruction. It didn't happen after Plessy versus Ferguson. It's just not going to happen because Alito wrote, you know, a stupid opinion justifying racial discrimination in voting. It's just, you know, black people are never going to stop fighting for their right to be free and equal. And so, you know, the fight is just simply not over. It's just not the end. What effect it will have on the parties, I don't know. But I know that this is not going to be the end of the story.
I would also think that the dynamics in terms of white people voting for black candidates has changed very significant ways that both would, I think, both impact Republican voters, but also, you know, like Democratic voters. I mean, I think there's just like a greater willingness by white people to vote for a black candidate in ways that we just can't predict in some of those seats. But with that said, obviously, there's going to be some type of political pushback, or hopefully. What do you think are the solutions to what we're seeing now? I mean,
I think there's a number of solutions. One is that you need to pass another Voting Rights Act, and you have to strip the Supreme Court of jurisdiction to hear it. And you also have to figure out a solution to the Supreme Court problem. Now, maybe that's a vacancy. Maybe that's adding seats to the Supreme Court. My view, and I expressed this years ago, was that the Roberts Court's jurisprudence on voting was interfering with the American people's ability to govern themselves, and therefore the constitutional harbor of adding seats to the court was justified. And this is not unprecedented. Republicans will try to tell you it's unprecedented, even though they have occasionally done it on the state level. But, you know, during
they've done three times in the past 5-10 years or so, I guess.
Yes. But, you know, even during Reconstruction, you know, the Republicans take away vacancies on the court. They shrink the court so that Andrew Johnson can't appoint anybody, and then they expand it after he's gone. So the idea that, you know, this is something that has never been done before, it is absolutely not true. And I think the issue here is not, it's not a question of like policy differences. Like, it would be one thing if the Supreme Court was simply conservative, but my view is that the Roberts Court is directly interfering with the ability of the American people to govern themselves, to exercise self-determination. And that is something that requires a hardball response.
How do you fashion a new Voting Rights Act where there's no jurisdiction? Like,
Congress has the authority to. I mean, jurisdiction stripping is something.
I know they have the ability to do that, but I mean, how, in reality, how does that end up functioning?
I do not know. There are a number of solutions. There are much smarter people than me who have figured out. Who have written up plans to sort of figure out how to get around the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this area. I mean, you know, when you look back at like Charles Sumner, his argument, he actually didn't think the 15th Amendment did not go far enough. And his argument was that the constitutional guarantee of a Republican government in every state already enfranchised all Black people, regardless of the amendment anyway. You know, I think there's a number of routes to do it. I think there is obviously no route that the current majority of the Supreme Court would accept. They have 6 votes. They could do anything they want with those 6 votes. And they have shown a complete disregard for the effects of their rulings when it comes to voting. They've just completely ignored the effect that they're removing the Voting Rights Act's protections has resulted in, you know, politicians trying to disenfranchise their Black constituents. It just does not seem to bother them at all. I mean, there was, you know, there were a couple of voting rights activists who objected to Alito's characterization of, you know, Black voting turnout increasing since Shelby County, since, you know, that wasn't actually true from Obama going forward. So it's misleading, and it's misleading in a way.
He also cited a fake fact, I think, in his ruling, is my understanding as well, along those lines. Not only he said 2 out of the last 5 elections, those two were before they got rid of Section 5 preclearance. But I believe there was another statistic that he cited that came from the brief that was not that was just not factual. I guess we'll see what the future brings in terms of this. It's going to be interesting, but the hostility. Oh, I guess I also want to add that their complete 180 on Purcell, the doctrine about interfering with, that seems to totally give up.
To elections, except, you know, when we want you to.
Unless they've already started.
Yeah.
Like, literally, unless people have already voted. I think it really gives away the game.
I mean, Alito sort of tiptoes around the idea. But, you know, the outrage that a lot of people on the left felt when the Supreme Court was allowing, you know, obvious racial gerrymanders to go forward, unconstitutional maps to go forward in elections on the grounds that it would be too confusing. I mean, I think their view is the reverse of that, which is that, you know, the maps that have, you know, like the Louisiana map with 2 Black districts, that was racist. Getting rid of the 2nd Black district wasn't racist. It just adding another Black district out of 6 in a state that is 1/3 Black, that to them was racist. I think Alito in particular. I mean, so the way to look at it, and the way to understand it, in my view, is that it's just the old reverse racism canard. that these laws that are meant to prevent racial discrimination are themselves racist against white people. And therefore, this is like a great injustice that is being righted. And why, and that's why they're allowing these maps to go forward, you know, regardless of their earlier rulings on the Purcell principle.
Adam Serwer, author, staff writer at The Atlantic. We will link to your piece on the on this Calais and the just sort of in general the Voting Rights Act. We really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Adam.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the show, as we call it.
I like this IM, if you don't mind me reading it, because I think it caps off our interview quite well. Carolina Commie says, this conversation is why any leftist claiming a material analysis should participate in elections. The lazy, inane arguments that voting doesn't matter or change anything contributes to the manufactured consent for these Supreme Court decisions. And guess what? These decisions bring us no closer to any sort of Leninist revolution. We are left even more powerless with no additional class consciousness to speak of. Lenin participated in elections to underscore their shortcomings. Abstaining altogether is just giving the fascists an unnecessary advantage. I think that's just really well said. Voting is a defensive measure in that way, and it's defensive on behalf of marginalized communities. It's insufficient and should not be the totality of one's class consciousness, one's political participation, ideally, and I know that's a lot to ask of people, but it if you are politically engaged and you're thinking about things in that kind of way, voting is important to just protect people in a small way.
All right, we're going to head into the fun half now.
Okay.
You can support this program by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half.
Yes.
Is my understanding.
Yes, you do.
And you can IM us and call the program. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use your coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's co-op, Madison, Wisconsin. Matt is ill. Do we know what's on his program?
Yeah, today at 2:45, Left Reckoning is premiering on YouTube, and Matt and David discuss AOC's take on the American Revolution before Rompelcone joins Matt to discuss AI cluelessness, Zoran, and politics in California. 2:45
cool.
Today.
Also, just want to plug, did it yesterday, but if you haven't checked out my episode of A Bit Fruity with my dear friend Matt Bernstein, please check it out. He brought me on to interview Mallory McMorrow, and it's making the rounds. It's there were some.
Yeah, I have like some non-political friends who were like, my God.
I know Matt like knows how to market himself on social media. Not Matt like Matt Bernstein in ways that we could probably learn from. Although I guess follow Matt on Instagram, right? That's his big plug.
Yeah, follow Matt on Instagram. So right after you follow Mr. Brian Vokey.
Yes.
Mr. Who?
Brian Vokey.
Oh, Mr. Brian Vokey, right.
Well, I mean,
and me too. I've reposted like three things.
That's amazing.
Wow. All this woodworking.
What? No, I think I reposted one of your things. I don't. I mean, I'm
it's
not
okay.
Sure.
I shouldn't have derailed.
I've done it. I've done it.
But please do check out that interview. I mean, I love Matt so much. He's so talented, and he's so good at like making people feel like, because he's so polite and soft-spoken.
Takes their guard down.
It just takes their guard. And yeah. She hated me. It seemed like she did not like me, and her voice, her tone would change when I would do the kind of more bad cop thing. But the thing is that Matt's not saying anything different than I'm saying. He's just doing it in a tone that's a little bit more, you know.
Do you think she hated you more than she hates living in Michigan?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, she really know. Liked, that was her big thing that she didn't like.
Yeah.
Hey, folks, don't forget, we got merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. People are talking about the Trump slump stickers. I'm starting to see those more at gas stations, food aisles in the supermarket. I don't know.
I slapped one on my wallet.
There you go. Sorry about that. Brian got docked for yesterday. Also, don't forget AM Quickie, amquickie.com. Get the news in your email inbox every morning at 9 a.m. Quick read, AM Quickie, three times a week. It's free. If you want it five times a week, a couple of bucks, but it's free. AMQuickie.com. Don't forget our Discord. We got, like, I think close to 20,000 people in there now, maybe more. MajorityDiscord.com.
Hype train.
See you in the fun half. Hype train.
That's
for
Twitch.
Twitch. I know, poggers.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on! To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.
Yes, hello. It's the fun half. I'm Sam Cedar, and this is Emma Viglin. And you got a question on the IMs. Jordy PhD says, when did Mallory realize Emma was in there? The video, it seems like you just pop in without introduction, unless they miss it. But you haven't seen the full video yet.
Oh.
Well, I haven't seen the full video.
Interview. No, it. She knew I was there from the beginning, but because we were in the podcast recording green room. So she knew I was there, but, you know, there's an option to put your display name in the recording, and I just said Emma. I didn't want to put my last name just in case her team wanted to do a quick lookup. And yes, Matt, again, stealth killer, Matt Bernstein, did not tell them that I was going to be on the interview. I was going to be on the interview before they canceled.
They just popped on and
yeah,
you were just there.
Her staff member was on mute, and then she was there as well.
And then did Matt say, "Oh, this is Emma"?
He said, "This is my co-host." You know, I occasionally have a co-host for these kinds of things. So, that was it. And again, his tone and how, like, polite he is, it's just, there's no way that they can be upset. And that's his secret weapon.
I am sort of like the opposite.
We all, I went out to dinner with Matt last night. We had a little cheers, a fun celebration for how our interview went. I think it went pretty well.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah. I think it's great.
What's the opposite effect?
I think I have the type of tone that people immediately feel defensive and, like, put off by me.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I went on to Jillian Michaels' show yesterday, and...
I'm so excited.
I don't know. Like, I imagine they're going to cut it up a lot because she uses a lot of AI in the middle of the interview.
How?
It was just the most awkward thing. First off, the debate. So just the backstory. The only time I've ever interacted with her, I was on Piers Morgan like a year ago. Maybe it was like more than a year ago, beginning of the Trump administration. It may have been like the first week or two when Doge was in full swing and they had just shut down USAID. And there was the stories of the pre-digested food that was still in like warehouses in Boston, I think in Georgia. And it was going bad for kids. And she said, oh, the kid's starving. That's a red herring. You know, oh, the starving kids thing, blah, blah, blah. Read a book. Mm-hmm. USAID is just comes in there and creates more harm than good with its agricultural policies. And I understood what she was saying. The U.S., via multiple ways, it has extracted wealth from these countries. They're extracted wealth by setting up their own agricultural system that is not necessarily appropriate for there. So that was when she had her challenge. I said, that, you know, I said, well, I'll do it. And Brian said he would love to talk. Sam would love to talk about your exchange. And so I went on there. Oh, and I read the book that she suggested. It's
right there.
It's right here. Yeah, I told her. She told me to read a book. She's like, read a book.
Do you get that from the library?
Save Three Lives. Actually, no, because I don't know if libraries still carry this. Because the book is from 1991.
Yeah, I...
And so...
It's old. That book is older than me.
It's an old book. And it's, you know, not a bad book. The ideas are... The guy feels more like a, less like a academic writing and more like something that, you know, I might write if I was more informed about a specific topic.
Okay.
So it was fine, but you know, again, it was nothing particularly new and it didn't have anything to do with USAID. And so I come on and the first, I want to say 15 minutes, she just keeps rolling clips of me, you, Matt. You can hear Brian sometimes in the background mocking her or saying mean things about her.
I'm glad I wasn't one of the insults because I told her in the email thread that between me, you, and the fence post, I hate all this mudslinging.
It's too much for your sensibility.
I mean, I was like, you know, and she's like... At one point, she played like at one point, I'm like, okay, look, I get it. I'm a mean person, and I lie about you, and I'll stipulate all of that. Can we have a conversation about like an actual topic? Mm-hmm. She played one clip of Matt. At this point, I'm like this, and she plays a clip of Matt. And at the end of it, like, it stops. And I'm just like, I'm about to leave because this is just like, she goes, and you said, yup. And I said, what? And she said, you said, yup. And I'm like, you know what? To be honest with you, I didn't listen to the clip. So I don't know what I was saying yup to. And she goes, well, you think you lie to your audience. You say, I'm an idiot. And I said, well, I think we still are trying to work that out right now. And then it was stuff like, you know, she didn't think that Iran counted as Trump being a wartime president.
Well, it's a 47-year-old war.
It's an excursion.
Despite what the Lancet says, she can only find documented evidence of 8 people dying because of the cutoff in USAID. And I'm like reading to her a piece from PBS from April of this year where they're saying like they have a 10% increase in death rate in Uganda because of the cutbacks just in one specific area of health care provided by USAID. There was a piece in the New York Times right now about what's going on, I think, in Sudan because of cuts to USAID. And then she started talking about the Wuhan leak and all the funding that USAID provided for Wuhan. And therefore, and
I'm glad she kept it timely.
And, it was a complete mess. I have no idea. I should have, I meant to record it on my end. I did not do that. So we'll see.
It did make me laugh with the insults she cited in our email threads. They all came from Emma.
Oh.
Like she kept said this, Sam said that, and then I'd be like, can you have a clip? And then it's Emma saying
that makes me proud.
Emma calling her a TERF.
And... yeah. You called her a TERF.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's unfair.
I stand by it.
My opinion about that is it's unclear to me that she's in any way a feminist. But if she is, I don't think she's a radical feminist. But I also, at the same time, like the kids today, they use TERF in a more colloquial way than like an academic might.
And I the acronym that I was thinking of is Trans-Exclusionary Radical Fitness Instructor.
Turfy.
Nice.
A turfy.
So I was correct.
That is well done. It didn't come up. She played the clip of it, but there was so many clips, and they were all like 4 seconds long. So I'm like, what's... It was like she was sad. Now, I imagine they're going to cut the hell out of it, because literally we're in the middle of things, and I'm going like, we have killed thousands of people in Iran. And she goes, oh, thousands? I don't know about that. And then she would go on to ChatGPT and go, and literally, like, she's reading it off to me. How many people did the United States kill in Iran? And I'm like, Jillian, are we really, what's going on here? And she goes, are these all civilians? I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah. She's prime age for, like, AI psychosis. I'm watching...
every right-wing show is doing this, though.
But it's insane. Yeah. Like, I'm watching, the new season of Couples Therapy, and there's a couple on there, and they have a political disagreement. The guy's a Trump supporter, you know, big tatted guy, obviously. And he's, like, telling the therapist about how ChatGPT makes him feel, like, you know, respected, and like his wife doesn't do that for him in his workout routine, and it tells me I'm doing a good job, and I'm like, so and that was later on after it had already been established how much he loves Trump. I'm like, this is the soft-minded idiot that can be taken for a ride like this. Like, how can you be flattered by a chatbot? If you're not a child whose brain is still developing, it's insane to me. And it's all these right wingers are obsessed with it. They're flattered by chat. They don't use it as a tool. They use it as like emotional, I don't know, satiation or validation. It's so weird.
It's almost nice like there's a lot of father issues.
Yes,
over there.
Yes.
My brain hurts. Uganda, Congo have an Ebola outbreak. 100 plus dead. BBC in a panic. Can you put that on USAID? I think that's a little bit more difficult. Although, you know, we'll have Mark Allen Derry on, I think, next week to talk about this. There's less that you can do to protect from this particular Ebola strain from what I've read, but that it's harder for it to, I think it's unlikely to be something that could be pandemic. It could be epidemic there, but USAID did not just like provide vaccinations. They provided stuff for like hygiene support and whatnot. I mean,
yeah,
on and on and on. And so I found the conversation with her to be sort of like fascinating. her capacity to deny all of these things. Her biggest point was that when RFK Jr. inverted the nutrition pyramid and then put SNAP requirements on places that sell that take SNAP foods, that they need to have more fresh produce. That was her big. That's why Trump was the lesser of two evils, and it remains to be seen how the implications of this SNAP requirements are going to happen. What may end up happening is you may actually get more food deserts because some of these places might just go like, it's just not worth it. Or the way that they get around it. Like, there's no enforcement mechanism here, right? Like, it's not like the FDA has the budget to go out and we're going to do inspections on the 250,000 bodegas that take SNAP benefits. All right, let's get to this. Let's do number three first, since we were Todd Blanche being grilled in front of the Senate budget hearing for the DOJ today, and Van Hollen is really questioning this guy. Remember, Donald Trump's defense attorney on January 19th, 2025, and then now is the acting attorney general, a guy who was told by the DOJ ethics lawyer to recuse himself to have anything to do with Donald Trump. He was the guy who interviews Ghislaine Maxwell to see if Trump had any involvement. As a member of the Justice Department, not as Trump's defense lawyer, although I should say that's the titles.
Right.
And also the guy who just handed Donald Trump a $1.7 billion slush fund.
Yeah, I mean, and the Ghislaine Maxwell thing, he interviewed her. She was like, yeah, Trump's totally innocent. And then what do you know? She gets sent to some cushy prison and she gets a puppy.
All Bureau of Prison regulations. She goes to a minimum security
prison. She's a sex offender. That's literally supposed to be not allowed. And you get reports of whistleblowers, other prisoners saying that they are feel like they are threatened if they speak badly about her and how she's getting all of this special treatment from within the prison. Like, couldn't be more obvious.
Did they represent? They asked for a meeting.
Can I ask you to commit that the Justice Department will not recommend a pardon for anyone named in the Epstein files?
Can you repeat that question? I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
Can you commit that the Justice Department, you, the acting Attorney General, will not recommend a pardon for people named in the Epstein files?
When you say people named, I have no, there's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of, quote, people named.
How about Ghislaine Maxwell? Can you commit that you will?
Yes, I can commit to that, of course.
Okay. Let me go. Glad to hear.
Of course. I don't even need to do that. Because my client, Donald Trump, I mean, the president, my former client, Donald Trump, knows exactly what he needs to do after I went to talk to her several months ago and got her to promise that she was going to shut up as long as she got a pardon.
Yeah. And we know that Trump himself is in the Epstein files, so it makes total sense that he can't make that commitment as his personal attorney. Oh, I mean, acting attorney general. And don't you dare accuse him of acting in that capacity.
He was literally told to recuse himself with everything to do with Donald Trump because he was his attorney the day before the inauguration.
Yes.
That's just a fact.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You can cite that as a fact, but that doesn't speak to anything other than the facts.
Four and five while we're here. Those are that's my favorite clip from this hearing.
All right, let's do this.
This is Van Hollen asking him about the specific case of a January 6er, and then we'll tell you the facts of the case afterwards.
So, let me go back to this slush fund because there's also an individual who, after being pardoned by the president, went on to molest two children. And that person actually tried to buy the silence of these children by saying that he would pay them some of the funds that he was hoping to get from your slush fund. Can you commit to making the rules so that that person is not eligible for a payout under this fund?
Well, you're obviously lying in your question, because there's no way that this person committed to that. But the slush fund, as you call it, which is not, didn't exist.
I'm sure,
but I can
lying.
Commit.
Mr. Attorney General, don't ever do that again. I am reporting
what
he said. He said on the expectation that he hoped to get some of the funds from a payout. He's been hearing
the, you said from the slush fund, Senator, and that didn't exist when he said that.
This is the fund that the president and all of you have been telegraphing all along that you're going to use to help the president's friends.
So he's referring to, like, Todd Blanche there is just lying, or is not familiar with it. This is from NPR from March of this year. So, you know, a little over 2 months ago. This is the individual here, Andrew Paul Johnson. He looks exactly like you would guess. Just months after President Trump's mass pardons for January 6 rioters freed him from prison, a Florida man, that's another shock, repeatedly sexually abused two middle school-aged children. On Thursday, the man, Andrew Paul Johnson, was sentenced to life in prison after a Florida jury found him guilty of five criminal charges, including molestation, lewdness, lascivious exhibition, and transmission of material harmful to a minor. Police reported that Johnson, 45, tried to keep the children quiet by telling them he would share millions of dollars in restitution money he expected to receive from the Trump administration in connection with his January 6th case. How freaking bleak is that? He's one of the several pardoned Capitol riot defendants who have been arrested for new crimes since receiving clemency for their actions during the 2021 insurrection.
And Todd Blanche is trying to pretend, Donald Trump's former defense attorney, Todd Blanche, is trying to pretend that it's impossible for this guy to have said that, although he's not refuting that. He's saying, like, maybe he was referring to a different slush fund. A hypothetically different slush fund that would pay out. How do you know that he was talking about this slush fund, which has been called the Donald Trump Restitution of January 6th Rioters Fund or something to that effect?
It's the mob lawyer.
This is, yeah. I have to say, Blanche is a very good defense attorney for Donald Trump.
Yep. So Van Hollen was not lying about that. You're obviously lying in your question. That is literally, unless, you know, he's trying to say that the cops are lying about this pedophile who's now been sentenced to life in prison on that very basis. Todd Blanche may want to check his facts. But this is so, like, this is dangerous. It seems like, okay, yeah, you know, in the grand scheme of things, Trump's waging this illegal criminal war in Iran and the economy's falling apart and we're cutting USAID and you know, millions are dying and the planet's on fire. But what he's trying to do here is set up, it's a protection racket, but he's trying to send a message with this. You, all the way down to the pedo brown shirts, you break the law on my behalf and we're going to reward you. And it's the same thing for the billionaires that are breaking the law on his behalf and all the corrupt deals that are benefiting him and enriching him. This is how you create a situation where he's completely immune from, like, you know, honestly, democracy.
It's also just the most corrupt. We are in such, I mean, we were already, this is the funny thing is that
yeah.
We had an interview a week ago with a guy who had done a comprehensive, Isaac Saul, had done a comprehensive list of all of Trump's incredibly corrupt things. And yet, we now have an extra $1.7 billion slush fund and reports now that Donald Trump has been day trading, or somebody in his on his account, worth $750 million in the past 3 months. And here it comes up on CNBC, and Jim Cramer, like...
Professional wrong man?
A professional wrong man. But what's fascinating about this is that, like, these guys are just simply not equipped to deal with the how blatantly corrupt this is. How much blatant insider trading. Like, there's no other... When you buy Boeing right before you know your government is about to issue a contract, when you buy, you know, whatever defense contractor right before you, you know, attack Iran, or when you buy Palantir because you know you're going to sign up, like, this is incredible. And these guys have no idea how to respond to it other than, like, nothing to see here.
Yeah. City today takes it to 130.
Yeah. But see, you know, the president, the U.S. government got in. He could sell it and
yes,
give that
and
the
according
number.
To the filings, the president's been trading some intel in the quarter. Yeah.
Yeah. Trade.
Yeah. Got nothing to say about
but.
What?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
All right. Don't worry. We're not having technical difficulties here, everybody, but we got to go.
Jim, we'll see you tonight. Mad Money, 6 p.m. Eastern time. S&P 7433.
He just went nonverbal.
I don't know if he thought he was joking around or if he was having a stroke or what, but that's the problem. There's no way. There is literally no way to discuss this in those spaces without coming off as like some type of shrill lunatic. So they just avoid it.
What are you going to do?
The president is running the government just basically as a way for him to siphon off cash. I mean, incidentally, this is a perfect example. If you want a microcosm for what's wrong with our economy, what Donald Trump is doing with the U.S. government, whether it's I'm going to get my pool painting guy to paint the reflection pool. I'm going to overpay him for that so I get all sorts of work done for free on my place. Whether it's I'm doing insider trading mm-hmm. because I know what the government is going to, what contracts we're going to put out, where we're going to buy from, what companies are going to succeed. So I'm basically front running the market. Or whether it's my own former personal lawyer is the head of the DOJ now, and I'm going to pretend to sue the government, and then he's going to give me a settlement for $1.7 billion that is my slush fund. Incidentally, we're being polite when we say slush fund because there's no oversight. And if it ends up in his pockets, you know, it's not going to be hard to, it's going to be hard to prove anything because there's going to be no paper trail. He's using the U.S. government in the same way that a lot of like C-suite CEO board of directors are using their corporations. It's just an extraction game.
Yeah.
How can I take money out of this? I don't care about the workers. I don't care about the future prospects of the product. I'm looking for the 5-year or 3-year or 2-year horizon on the stock valuations because that's the way I get paid.
Yeah. I mean, Cramer, that was either just like him being stunned by the level of Trump's corruption or I don't think it's that. I think it's more him kind of not knowing what to say because of how corrupt it is and being afraid that Trump was going to spout off against him at some point. I mean, Trump has tried to, and in many ways has effectively done so, bullied the media into silence about his corruption. Very We've talked about this before. Like, how is this not the story every single day? How many freaking days did we hear about Benghazi? How many, like, how many segments has conservative media done on Nancy Pelosi's insider trading, which is egregious, and she's made a lot of money if you follow her. But what Trump is doing is, it's not just insider trading with that knowledge. In this instance, it is. But in all the other instances of corruption that we're talking about, he's literally just looting the government and putting it in his pocket.
But we needed a businessman to run this country.
Yes.
Exactly. Donald Trump's very upset about his ballroom because the Republicans have a reconciliation bill. Reminder, reconciliation is a specific process that you can use for legislation, but there's a lot of rules on it. And what it allows you to do is it is filibuster proof in the Senate, and it is privileged in the House. So you only need 51 votes in the Senate.
However, the rules of reconciliation is that it needs to be budget neutral. Needs to have impact on the budget. Needs to be budget neutral. Now, of course, they're not going to raise any taxes. And the nature of the ballroom, apparently, according to the parliamentarian, is not eligible for a reconciliation vote. It needs to be voted on like regular legislation in terms of providing money for it. And therefore, it would require, you know, a 60-vote threshold. Donald Trump is pressuring John Thune to fire the parliamentarian, which you can do to go around. George W. Bush did this to cut taxes for wealthy people. In fact, the Republicans have ignored the parliamentarian multiple times just in this term. But John Thune doesn't want his senators to have to vote $1 billion for the ballroom, so he's letting it stand. So here's Donald Trump going out there trying to pretend it's for something different than the ballroom so that it will pass the parliamentary
muster. I can't
say
muster. It's a war. I can't say this ballroom is for tax.
It's something special.
Unchain me.
U.S. Supreme Court. So here's a couple of things you can look at. How are you? All right. There will never be another thing like this. I don't believe Bill. From a court standpoint, this is all my money and donors' money. This is tax-free. So everyone's talking about they're going to give money, they're going to give money. The money they're going to give is really for the security of that and the whole White House premise. And I guess you probably need that nowadays. We've done the fencing on the outside of the White House. It's all titanium. You see the black fencing. That's been just done recently. And it was approved originally by me, and it's been completed, and it's very powerful, very powerful. A tractor, a bulldozer cannot knock it over. It goes down deep, and it's titanium, which is the strongest of all of the metals, much stronger than steel, as an example. The ballroom is all, it's going to be a tremendous, tremendous thing. As an example, what happened a couple of weeks ago at the White House Correspondents' Dinner could not happen here. One thing that we have is we don't have people living above it. We don't want that. That's no good. They have 1,000 units above it with the elevator coming.
Okay, he's just rambling now. Yeah. Like, hotel, big, we need security.
Big truck, big, big steel. Titanium, stronger than steel. Back to his roots.
Once we have a ballroom, I'll no longer have to stage assassination attempts at White House correspondents' dinners.
Yeah, right. I know. Man, I'm telling you, there's something fishy about that. The manufacturer consent for the ballroom. But like, we didn't get to it with Adam Serwer, but he mentioned like how his base is based in nostalgia. And like, I really, the nostalgia can be in many ways like kind of a force of conservatism and fascistic. I mean, Trump is trying to recreate a world that has passed him by, and the ballroom is a
part
of
it too.
Yeah, yeah. But I notice it.
Yeah, make America great again.
Yeah, and I think in this time too of techno fascism, if you're on social media a lot like I am, notice that everything is nostalgia content right now. The shows you used to like. Don't look forward. Don't look at new artists, trans artists.
Watch the Malcolm in the Middle reboot.
Right, right. Oh, I mean that has always, I guess, existed, but I think Hollywood's in a bad way, so like they're relying more on that nostalgia stuff. But it's specifically your algorithm. It's keeping you in a mental space where it's like, oh, wasn't it great when I was 19 years old or 14 years old? And I actually think it's counter-revolutionary and not a coincidence that those tech oligarchs are also, you know, on board with Trump. It keeps you in a state of complacency and not looking towards the future. And that it benefits Trump.
I can maybe send you a couple of woodworking accounts and that will take care of that.
Okay, fair enough.
I love BBC documentaries, like the archives, and every comment is, this country no longer exists.
Yes.
We've lost this country.
Right. I mean, you
translate, I don't like living next to people who are from another country.
Or like the AI videos of the 80s, like this is what things used to be. And of course, it's the frickin' 80s. Yeah. And you look at the 80s, speaking of Reagan in that time, so much of those movies that were coming out were about 50s nostalgia.
Yeah.
like Back to the Future, which also weird stuff about his mom in that. That I rewatched that recently. That movie is, you know, I forgot about that stuff.
Yeah, some strange stuff. Very strange stuff. Hey, let's do this. Now, Representative Marie Glusenkamp Perez, not our favorite congresswoman. She's,
I can't believe we're doing this.
She's, well, listen, I want to give credit where credit's due. Although she gets something really fundamentally wrong. I don't like her politics. And I understand here, because on some level we agree, but we also have a very serious fundamental disagreement. Here she is.
This is important.
On the House floor. Well, it is. You know what? This is not dissimilar from Mallory McMurrow. The idea of like knee-jerk blame government for stuff that is really a function of other things, I think, is very problematic.
I think we all remember being presented with a really gross Red Delicious apple in school cafeterias. Maybe you like them. If you do, you're wrong. But Red Delicious, as we know in Washington State, are an inferior apple. And, you know, then people argue that the kids just aren't eating fruit because they don't like it. And it's like, well, yeah, if you gave them an old boot leather to eat, they wouldn't eat that either. It's really it's not about, you know, it's important that we offer quality fruit that is can compete with Cheetos or whatever kids are eating these days.
Okay. She is correct. The Red Delicious apple is a horrible apple. But people have to understand what was going on with the Red Delicious apple.
People do have to understand.
It became a commodity because of the way it looks. It's very red. It looks nice. But here's the other thing. It has very thick skin, so it can travel more. It stays intact. So it could be easily commodified by apple growers. It's also very, very popular in Asia, despite the fact that it tastes like cardboard. But it's not a question of the government making that determination. The government actually just purchased what was the most readily available, least expensive apple. And so they buy that one. But it really is a function of the way that, you know, capitalists function at that time. They're just going to put out what is the most deliverable apple rather than a quality apple. Now, the good news is, and if you're a longtime viewer of this program, you already know this because I told you this back in 2016. Because I knew this was happening because of I was friends with an apple wholesaler at the time. In 2018...
Did you guys have a falling out?
We did, actually.
He stopped carrying Arkansas Blacks.
It was over the pristine. But it's not a point. In 2018, the Gala apple replaced the Red Delicious as the genuine apple commodity. Mm-hmm. The one that was, like, most produced. And so it took a little time. So this is not a government problem. This was an apple industry problem, and the apple industry, to its credit, has corrected.
Wow.
More like red deliverable, right?
100%. Now, for whatever reason, apparently in Asia, people still appreciate the Red Delicious apple, but I think it has to do more with, in certain cultures, I think maybe in Chinese, certain Chinese cultures, the bright red is good luck.
It is a little desperate to put delicious in the title. It does feel like they're lying to you.
Totally.
I'm just so tickled by your attempt to make this educational. I mean,
she's going out there blaming government, and it is a perfect example of like, no, this is not government's fault. If you went and bought a bunch of Gala when it wasn't the apple commodity, people are going to be talking like, oh, you... Why are you spending all that money? I mean, there's an anti-tax sentiment that led to a lot of these problems, and it is not helped by blaming the government for the Red Delicious apple, because any store you go into, same damn thing.
Yeah, no. I don't mean to take away from the joy that you felt being able to talk about apples in this context, but...
I mean, it's true, and it also, you know, like, it's just the red apple, Red Delicious, which is easier to produce. more disease resistant, more pest resistant. But the Gala, fortunately, which is a perfectly competent apple, mm-hmm. has replaced it as the commodity apple.
Don't get me started on bananas. I feel the same way.
What do you mean?
We only use one species of banana. We're killing off all the other ones. There's far more delicious bananas.
Is that true?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
What are they?
I don't know. I just, that's where my knowledge ends. I actually don't. That's just what people told me.
I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
No, it's true. I just don't know what the names are of the varieties.
Anyways, I'm glad I got off that.
Yeah, I'm really glad too. It's your special interest. Well, it's endearing.
Here's another example, though. Oh. Of somebody doing it the right way, pushing back against the notion that government is the problem. This is Zohran Mamdani, who, incidentally, when I was talking to Jillian Michaels, was like, oh, I'll tell this story afterwards.
Okay.
Here's Zohran Mamdani at Hunt Point, South Bronx, which is going to be the site of the first city-run grocery store in New York City.
I love how he approached this, and I think, you know, he maybe tested this out, this line before, but he nails it here.
I cannot help but think of the words of our 40th president, Ronald Reagan. He famously said, "The 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, 'I'm from the government and I'm here to help.'" It's a good quote, but I disagree. I think 9 more terrifying words are actually, "I worked all day and can't feed my family." We are going to use the power of government to lower prices and make it easier for New Yorkers to put food on the table. When government understands its purpose as serving the very working people that it has left behind time and again, it can make a difference in the most pressing struggles facing our city today. It's not just that government can help. It's that government must help. And our government will help.
Boom.
Aside from the fact that the policy he's talking about is a great policy, it's just great messaging. Like the idea that people should have faith in government and government has an obligation to deliver.
Yes. Well, he believes it. We don't have Democrats making that case. You know, Cory Booker's like shitting himself on the Senate floor to just rail about whatever. And like, you could be making the case for government itself. But if you are a liberal and not a leftist, you don't actually believe in the power of government to transform people's actual material lives. You believe that the market is a more efficient way to do that, and the government is there to put guardrails on the market.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a backstop, as you say. And Zohran doesn't believe that. Like, he is doing God's work in creating trust in government again, and it's not just confined to New York. And he's doing it, by the way, through like delivering, fulfilling his campaign promises that people said he could never do, and making sure that like the New York City government is robust and responsive. You saw that with the snow and everything like that, but also in just, you know, the little ways. And it's important for people to have trust in government again, because the federal government is making it so that they're gutting the federal government. And when some New Yorkers are interacting with the federal government, it's about like they're throwing your cousin into an ICE gulag. This is a positive vision.
Yep. When I was on with Jillian Michaels, she accused me of being a liar.
Yes.
Because we were reacting to her saying that there are Iranians on the streets of New York saying that Mamdani sounds just like the Ayatollah. And we said, that's ridiculous. And she said, then she showed me a clip of a woman, an Iranian diaspora protester, being interviewed, saying that Mamdani's just like the Ayatollah. She said,
"Nailed you.
See, you lied.
Owned.
You lied." And I said, "The issue is not whether there is a protester who says that Mamdani is the Ayatollah." I said, "Tell me why you think he's a jihadist and a communist." And she said, well, that's not the point. The point is you lied about there being a protester, the people on the streets saying this.
So the whole interview is basically about her complaining that we were mean to her?
Yeah.
I would say
a whole career.
What is going on in politics, in political media? It's the influencerification of everything. It's, oh, me, I'm in the center. I mean, Candace Owens has been doing that.
Do you know what it's like?
I don't,
Emma,
know.
No. To have people say, that's ridiculous that there are Iranian diaspora protesters on the street saying that Mamdani is like the Ayatollah, and saying that's ridiculous that someone would say that, and then it turned out to be true, and walk around with that scarlet letter of Sam Cedar and Emma Vigeland said it was ridiculous, the idea that there were protesters calling Mamdani Ayatollah Khomeini. Do you have any idea what it's like?
I don't know. I can't empathize with her plight.
Wake up in the morning, look in the mirror, and regardless of all the good you see.
It's because wokeness is blinding me to actually understanding and having empathy.
Great cloud over your head.
I know. Jillian knows a lot about empathy when she's screaming at people and giving them diet pills. Fatty!
You don't remember when Tim Pool did this to you? You don't walk around carrying those aspersions that he slung at you?
No, I mean, no, I choose to wear them as a badge of honor, but, you know, I'm not as sensitive as Jillian.
All of the mentality of conservatives is aggrievement. And it just takes forms in different ways. Black people are, getting all the Cialis ads, or they're getting
straight from Nick DePaulo's ad.
Representation or whatnot. Yeah, exactly. Or people are being mean to me, or people are going around saying that I lied about there being a protester who said that Mamdani was the Ayatollah Khomeini. I mean, it's just, it's fascinating.
Is the Ayatollah meant to be a communist?
Yes. Apparently, the Ayatollah was also a fake, had promised all sorts of free things.
Mm. Ooh.
Okay.
And I was like, well, how about we just talk about what the assertion itself? And then she changed, I think. I can't remember even what happened. At one point, I just went to my happy place and didn't go there. Oh, but let's talk about another right-winger who has some theories. Well, I don't know if he's a right-winger. Would you say that Jim Brewer is a right-winger, or is he just a free thinker?
I would say he's
a free thinker.
He's just a star in the Bruniverse.
Exactly. You know?
Right. That's the name of his podcast, The Bruniverse?
Yeah, it's The Bruniverse.
I'm so glad that he gets to podcast and we get to hear his thoughts.
Here's the thing. And I don't know that you could call him right wing, although, you know, that he was sort of aligned with that for a while. And now he's sort of just like gone off into more. And really, there isn't a lot of like a political salience to this per se. But wait, this video got almost 450,000. Is that right?
No, that's nine. That's nearly a million.
It's almost at a million. Yeah.
A million
views. Where is that? Where?
944K.
Oh, 944. Holy cow. So almost a million views. And
Here I was thinking this is just another indulgence of Sam's because you love making fun of Jim Brewer so much, but potentially he's having an impact.
Well, that's the thing is that, you know,
God, people are so dumb.
This is so disturbing. Now look, we're both skeptical of AI for a lot of different reasons. Ranging from the resources it uses to the hype that it's getting, to how it's employed in terms of like the national security state and as a weapon of war. What it's going to do to jobs. There's all sorts of reasons to be skeptical of AI. And Brewer basically takes that, ingests it, digests it, and has it come out some weird orifice that is not
where it should be.
Yes. Go ahead.
Do you understand? Whether you think it's your governor, your president, your congressman, we only get to see, just like Jennifer Aniston or any celebrity or whatever, you only see what the media shows you. Do you realize that? And if you think about AI, how many videos do we watch of AI?
I just want to say one thing about this. Like, that's true to an extent, but one of the beauties about social media, if not like the one sort of best thing about it, is that it has democratized our access to information. Not totally. Certainly there's a lot of stuff hidden, but you get a lot of like candid moments.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not exactly true. But
do people need to be explained that people don't just freeze when you're not looking at them like a ghost in Super Mario Brothers?
I think there are people who think that they get the full picture and they don't. And so I think, you know, I'm trying to be generous here to Jim.
Okay.
Holy crap. I was totally into the Bigfoots for a while. The Bigfoots were
No, go back.
Were
go back
nutso.
A little bit, you
and then
skipped over a little bit. Sorry.
How many videos do we watch of AI and we're like, holy crap, I was totally into the Bigfoots for a while. The Bigfoots were nutso, and then came all these other AI. Now I'm watching the cats waking up their owners in the middle of the night. The cats waking up the owners are freaking hilarious. Like a cat comes in, and it looks real. Bedroom door slams over, and a cat comes in, and he sets up a drum set. It looks, you're like, holy crap, there's a cat. Playing, I'm watching dogs doing Michael Jackson dances. It looks real. Do you ever take the time and think, you really think AI is just showing up now?
Here we go.
Or do you think maybe AI's been around a long time?
Oh,
long
no.
time.
Long time.
Let me just explain this to you. Star Wars, the movie, the last trilogy, whatever you call it, had two dead people starring in it that they AI'd throughout the whole movie. And I didn't even know one of them was dead for 20-something years. Now,
hold on.
Pause it for a
second.
Hold on.
Now, he's talking about Carrie Fisher,
yes,
right?
And it was horrible. It looked dumb and obvious.
Well, also, now, Brian, you're from Hollywood.
Yes.
Was that AI or was that known as special effects?
Yeah, we also call that CGI.
Yes.
Computer.
You know what? We were one of the early adopters of the AI right here where we had this image appear on the screen that says the Majority Report.
You know what?
How do we do that?
What's so funny is when we had last week, we had Alex Hanna on to talk about AI. And she was saying how the AI industry is calling a lot of things that are not AI, AI, because it creates all this hype. And Jim is just so stupid that he's uncritically using that exact framework and not even realizing it.
But here's the important part. If you start to articulate this to your million people who watch this video, and let's say just, I don't know, 10% actually take what you're saying seriously. Then you start going like, the moon landing, fake. All the other stuff. Like, this is a way to completely destroy people's understanding of what is or is not factual in the world. Now, whether he knows that or not, I don't know, because I think he's probably a little bit
experiencing AI psychosis.
Well,
maybe
I don't
that's
know if
too
I would,
far.
I'm not a clinical. I'm not a a doctor, but it could be time for an intervention. But let's just go back
a
little.
I do get the sense that he's a little bit more kind-hearted than the average person we make fun of on this.
Well, 100%. I think he's probably his heart might be in the right place. Although I also
his
remember like
not.
Where he was a couple years ago. He seems to have traveled from there, but he was, for a while, he was going, like, hardcore. He was... Like,
the vaccine broke his brain.
Yeah.
But how are you an adult where it's like, okay, Jim Brewer, I'm not saying he's cultured, but he's, like, been probably to different parts of the world. How are you this old and this enamored with videos of Bigfoot and cats doing Michael Jackson dances?
I don't know if you understand how often stand-ups are alone.
Yes. I mean, that part does not in any way shock me whatsoever.
For months at a time.
These are just children.
Now, that was, I don't know how many years ago that came out. 5 years ago, 10 years, 7 years ago? Which means they had the technology before that because they had to film it and put it in.
Ooh.
Did you ever think, wow, can you imagine if they used AI for government and government officials with people that weren't even real? I know that sounds a little kooky.
A little bit.
Or images of whatever they want to show you.
Like the moon landing.
You really don't know anymore.
Yeah.
I remember going to Disney World when Epcot Center first opened. And like, I don't even remember. I went there in 1987, 88. And I went to Epcot Center and they were showing the future. It's a big globe. And in the and they were showing you talking on phones and FaceTiming on a computer. And they were like, in the future. Now, A, how would they know that? How did they know that? B, how long have they known that? And C, just building that part of Disney had to take years and years. There's so much stuff we have no clue.
All right, pause it for a second. Let's see if we can take a tackle at A, B, and C. Because I will say I was also at Epcot Center in, I think it was 87, spring break 87. I went down there with Mark Morris from college. We stayed at his grandmother's place in Boynton Beach, in like a community. And we took mushrooms and went on Epcot Center. And I will say that he is right. There were things like where you could actually talk to someone and see their face on like a TV and that you would hold hands. Where could they have gotten these ideas if they didn't already exist? Let's see. Oh, I know. Here's a cartoon from the 1960s. It's called The Jetsons.
1962,
The Jetsons. Imagine that. That must be proof that that existed. Where else could they possibly get the idea?
Hanna-Barbera, who are you working for?
I mean, can you imagine, though, like, how could you imagine, like, what AI could do today that if it didn't already exist? You'd have to have, like, I don't know, you'd have to be some type of, like, fantasist or maybe filmmaker. Brian?
I'm working on it. It won't drag over.
Boop, 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 boop.
I'm trying to find a video of the guy who faked the moon landing.
Well,
no, I'm talking, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
Oh, yeah. I mean, the idea that he is out there trying to undercut like our understanding of just reality because he can't get it through his head that people had the idea of did you ever see Star Trek? They're walking around with cell phones.
Whoa. How did they figure that out?
They would call them communicators, and they were literally like the flip phone. Or I've talked before about that steamer trunk I found with a futurist who said, by the end of the century, we're going to have little TVs on our wrists, like watches, and they're going to get messages. They're going to get like images from satellites in the sky, and they're going to be powered by propane. So there's so close.
But they can't make it too obvious.
But of course, how could we have even imagined AI without it existing?
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
There you go. There it is. Proof that AI has been around for a long time.
But Kubrick was a guy. Isn't he the guy that all the conspiracy theorists say faked the moon landing?
Was it Kubrick who did it? Who faked the moon landing? I didn't know.
Isn't that who they say did it?
And what's so fun? Can we go back to just the video for Sec of Brewer because I want to read the comments section.
Oh, let's go back. Well, he's got a little bit more to say, I think.
Oh, he does. Okay, good. Maybe. Then we'll get to that because that was more depressing than I anticipated.
Yeah. And brings me back to, you could sit and complain about it, or you can sit and live in it. Oh, the virus is coming. Oh, no. Or you can buy into this world that we call the Matrix or whatever you want to call it. Or just, dude, I'm tap out. I'm out. I don't watch the news. I don't watch the news. I don't care about politicians. I don't even watch sports anymore. I don't. I'd rather just play sports than actually watch them.
Wow.
Because I know for a fact, I know specific professional players that have talked about games being rigged. So it's like, what is real anymore? What is real anymore? Did you guys watch the comedy roast?
Okay, let's get out of here. The funny thing is he thinks that comedy roast was real.
Somebody roasted comedy?
What is real anymore? Anyways, let's move on to the comedy roast.
So the AI companies are deliberately marketing themselves as tech futuristic and trying to make their technology sound like something that would appeal to baby brain people that still think of everything in terms of Disney movies or Disney rides, I should be fair. Or is it Epcot a ride? I'm an adult.
Yeah, Epcot
is a small world.
Oh, right, right. Okay.
No, it's Small World after all. It's a different ride in Disney. Epcot is the big globe.
Oh, the golf ball.
The golf ball, yeah. And you go through and you see the future. The whole exhibit is literally what we anticipate in the future.
It was just seeds planted by...
But look at these. I mean, stay safe, Jim. No one is more hated than he who speaks the truth. We need the glasses from the movie They Live, which is such a dumb movie, but whatever.
Comedians have always been saying the truth out loud.
Jesus Christ. The Jetsons cartoon had FaceTime in the 60s. What is that supposed to prove?
Well, he's saying what we were saying, I guess, was basically like, that's how they had the idea. Like, it wasn't such a crazy idea that you would be able to talk to somebody on TV. TV was a much bigger idea than the idea that we'd each have, like, a way to transmit TV signals.
You are rapidly becoming one of the most clear-speaking voices of our generation? Oh, man. It is refreshing to hear you reason in the open and...
Reason out in the open and verbalize those thoughts many of us think, but would hesitate to bring up.
Because you would sound like you have the mental capacity of an 11-year-old?
I will object. I love They Live. I love John Carpenter.
Well, I do like that 25-minute fight scene, just for, like, humor, but that movie is very dumb.
I love that movie, but it didn't shape my view of the world.
But I'm telling you, there are a lot of people that grew up in the 80s that are like, you know, that's where we're at right now, man.
Totally.
Put on the glasses. And they're all experiencing AI psychosis, and they all are stupid like Jim Brewer.
Should we do number 13?
Sure.
I don't know how much we spoke about this opinion piece by Nicholas Kristof. Not always my favorite writer, but kudos to him for writing this in the New York Times.
And by the way, you're right to say opinion piece, because they put it in the opinion section. Screams Without Words, the mass rape propaganda piece that now has been uncovered to contain many mistruths, was of course splashed in the front of the New York Times. No caveat about it being opinion, but Nicholas Kristof wrote in a as you say, an impressive piece and a needed one that has been available. All of this information has been available. If you've been watching this show, you'll know that Israel has been raping Palestinian prisoners, and they're using tactics like having dogs do it. And they're mutilating their genitals. And Kristof wrote a piece about it in the Times, and now the government of Israel is suing the New York Times, saying that it contained falsehoods. We have it on video. We have one of the rapes on video with the guards shielding. They think that they have the angle away from the camera, but you're able to see some of it.
And he writes, the piece is The Silence That Meets the Rape of Palestinians. He writes, there's no proof that the Israeli government ordered the systemic rapes and sexual violence. But then he goes through and tells multiple stories of this. And, you know, the fact that this happened in the New York Times, even though it's in the opinion section, is indication that it's getting harder and harder for Israel to keep this from the American public. I mean, the Israeli public seems to know about it.
And they like it.
Largely, not totally, not hashtag not all Israelis, but the overwhelming majority of them seem to be absolutely fine with it. Christoph writes, the Save the Children commissioned a survey last year of children ages 12 to 17 who had been in Israeli detention. More than half reported witnessing or experiencing sexual violence. Save the Children said the true figure was probably higher because stigma left some unwilling to acknowledge what happened to them. The Committee to Protect Journalists, a respected American organization, surveyed 59 Palestinian journalists who had been released by the Israeli authorities after the October 7th attacks. 3% said they had been raped. 29% said they endured other forms of sexual violence. He goes on. I mean, he talks about Palestinians that he interviewed. It's a very important piece to read. And worth sending your friends who might still consider themselves Zionists. Now, the capacity for Zionists to ignore this information from a guy, you know, Christoph is not exactly a screaming liberal or left winger, as it were. It goes on and on. Here is Meghan McCain, though. She is outraged. Remember, her mom.
Yes. No.
Is it her mom or stepmom?
Stepmom. I'll look it up. Cindy GHF McCain. Reporting. Cindy McCain.
Cindy McCain it runs a...
The World Food Program.
The World Food Program, which has been highly critical of the way that Israel has weaponized hunger and famine against the Palestinians in Gaza.
And I guess Meghan is her daughter. So, I mean, I wonder what those Thanksgiving conversations are like.
For people that don't know, Nicholas Kristof wrote this absolutely insane article that doesn't seem to be fact-checked, that exploded all over the internet. That
I thought this was The Onion when I saw that. I was like, same. What the hell am I even looking at?
So the opinion piece is alleging that Israeli soldiers and prison guards sexually abused Palestinian prisoners, including claims that dogs were used as part of that abuse.
One woman, 23 at the time of her detention, told me that she was regularly stripped naked, forcibly bent over, and groped all over her body by male and female guards. One journalist said he had been held down and by a dog, a claim backed by other accounts from prisoners who report they underwent the same thing.
The allegations about military dogs to sexually terrorize detainees, it's been not that this we even should even have to say this, but dog trainers and the American Kennel Association say that this is physically impossible. It is something that's made up. You cannot train a dog to do anything like that. It's really disgusting that I even have to say that. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the article hideous.
She's talking about it's impossible to train a dog to, penetrate a human being. I don't have an opinion on that or any knowledge about it, but it's certainly possible to train a dog to bite your genitalia. Yeah. I mean, that's just a dumb, like, when you read an article like that and you resort to finding the debate about whether dogs can be trained to sexually assault someone, you know that you're trying to avoid the topic.
I mean, genocide denier. And it's even more important right now to not have those denials than it is to be able to look with history in the rearview mirror and accurately call things like the Holocaust, the Shoah, genocide. It's the same equivalent as being a Holocaust denier if you are denying this in front of your face, in this moment as a genocide because it's there's an opportunity to stop it. So it's actually more morally repugnant to engage in what she's doing.
It's also morally repugnant coming from somebody whose father was tortured for, what, 5 years?
100%. I mean, let alone what her mother's work is doing. It's disgusting.
I wonder if she denies her father's claims of what Vietnamese prison.
I don't think she would ever deny anything her dad said. Never, ever.
Her podcast is called Citizen McCain.
Yeah. You think she's seen Citizen Kane?
Right. Yeah. Do we keep going? Who is this other guy down there, too? I recognize him. I think it's Jason Rance. Oh, I was on CNN with him. Yes, that was the guy that defended the drug boat killings.
A dog to do anything like that. It's really disgusting that I even have to say that. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the article hideous and distorted lies. And now there are reports that the state of Israel will actually be suing or is considering suing the New York Times. I say to that, sue them to hell. This, my problem, I have many problems with this. But for every person on social media and every host that I see, particularly on the right, you know who you are, pushing the boundaries of talking about Israel and talking about Jews the way they have. And we know who you are. Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, Megyn Kelly. We know who you are. I'm going to say their names when everybody else won't. You are leading, you are making these articles more socially acceptable. The reason why the New York Times was okay printing this is because so many of you have bred the environment where talking in this way and talking about Jews and talking about Israel this way has now been normalized. I am horrified that the New York Times decided to print this, Jason. Horrified and confused. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, not just print it, but they're backing the story.
They are pretending.
I mean, they put out a number of statements, I think, that any reasonable person could look at and say, okay, they're still backing him. Well, at the same time, and I think this is, again, the tell. If it were true that the Israeli government somehow was able to defy everything we know about dogs and actually trained dogs to do this.
Well, Bobby, they're making the whole story about the dogs. People in the IMs are saying that Pinochet had trained dogs to do this, Galactic Nurse Boogs says, I did an event with a doctor who worked with Dr. Al-Burush in Gaza, who was raped to death. Also, the dogs are trained by soldiers spraying hormones on the detainees. Double Down News has a good report on it. It's so infuriating when I talked about the doctor I referenced earlier and some cultish Zionist tells me I'm lying. Aside from the debate as to whether this is possible, which I imagine, of course, it is in some fashion or another, the fact that this is what they're focused on, because it's the, you know, one thing that people they know won't go and research, as opposed to, like, watch the video where 12 Israeli soldiers, prison guards, hide the raping of a Palestinian prisoner from cameras that are shooting. You could see it.
Yes, and the rapist on camera, all charges were dropped against him, and he's on Israeli TV regularly as a celebrity.
Trained dogs to do this. Seems like that would be a pretty big news story. Why is it that the New York Times newsroom is not covering this? It's because it's not true. The op-ed standards for reporting should be no different when you're looking at just facts as being reported as a newsroom. And yet, I think that's exactly what happened here. I mean, the sourcing on this is, well, I spoke to some people who hate Jews and have ties to Hamas, and they're making these claims, and they told other people about it. So that's the proof. That's not proof. It's so absurd. And again, why are we not getting more pushback from other mainstream outlets?
This is honestly, the Screams Without Words reporting that has now been debunked in many ways, that one, the reporter was a documentary filmmaker with no previous experience and spoke to people in the exact way that he's speaking about. And it was all secondhand. They'd heard about this assault by Hamas. They had heard that Hamas was doing this systemically. Everything he's accusing this opinion piece of is exactly what Screams Without Words did and why it was debunked. Kristoff is a seasoned reporter, has done this for many years, decades now, and spoke to the victims directly.
I mean, but also, he quotes B'Tselem, which is the Israeli human rights organization, links to their documentation of a grave pattern of sexual violence towards Palestinians. A former Israeli officer in prison infirmary, then it's linked, describes in testimony to the Israeli group Breaking the Silence that what that kind of acceptance means in practice, that this sexual violence against Palestinians has become an accepted norm. You see normal, pretty ordinary people reaching a point where they abuse people for their own amusement, not even for an interrogation or anything, for fun, to have something tell the guys or revenge. It's the idea that it's just people who hate Jews they're running out of a runway with this. They're running out of runway. This is for themselves now.
Yeah. Or, you know, for Zionists. I mean, like, increasingly this seems like this show gets many views, but I still always wonder what some of the backers are for some of this conservative media.
We'll have to do the Ashley St. Clair thing tomorrow. This could be a bigger deal. I mean, I think certainly I hope some Democratic lawmaker, if they take the House and Congress, have a hearing or two and invite her to one. That'd be interesting to find out about. All right, let's read some IMs and then we'll get out of here.
All right.
As long as we covered the Apple stuff, I feel like I've done my job.
I almost FaceTimed you from the farmer's market to see which species of apple I should get.
Alex from Germany. I am so happy you show clips of these nut jobs so I don't have to spoil my fairly well-curated YouTube algorithm with this BS. Yes. Well, you're welcome. That's part of it. Pennsylvania comrade. Why so early? Folks, speaking of PA, go out and vote for Chris Robb. If you haven't already, I know everybody who listens to the show has voted.
Yes.
Future reactionary. With the way everyone is talking about and foisting AI onto us, it's impossible to believe they had it for a while and we're just keeping it under wraps, indeed. Greg from Pittsburgh. I just bet $100 on Thomas Massie. Because AIPAC had lined up against him. I'm against this kind of betting, but damn it, anything I could do to keep a foreign country from buying seats seems to be worthwhile. I'm not sure if that helps. Oh, maybe on a... as a libertarian, I'm still waiting for the Thomas Massie is in the most expensive rigged election against AIPAC coverage. JR in Philly. Sam chill-mogging Emma. Let me guess, Jim. AI rolled out just a bit before January 6th. Super Kings. Oh, boy, I can't wait to tune into the show at 12.05 p.m. Central and hear the new Fun Half song. Surely Sam won't F it up 8 days in a row.
It's not Sam's job.
It is not my job.
It is me who is effing it up.
Mark Wayne Mulligan, what is anyone accomplishing by resigning instead of resisting the administration until they're fired or removed? Isn't it tantamount to letting them install people who will capitulate without resistance? This is always a big debate, right? I mean, I've been on side, you know, I've criticized people for not resigning. I mean, I think that's a tough, that is a tough thing. Like, I don't know. It's probably so position specific and context specific and timing specific. I don't know. Maybe that Treasury lawyer thought, like, I've done everything I can do.
Right.
I can't stop this. Maybe I can be part of a political movement. I just don't know. Somebody, Sam is fun today. Oh, thank you. The USA is and always has been an oligarchy, not a democracy. The difference between the founders' plantation system and the billionaires' monopolies is that power is far more concentrated today. Ad hominem. Cavendish bananas.
Thank you. I thought you were deliberately skipping all those banana IMs.
No, I didn't. I didn't. Hack all things. See, Sam, when you say poggers, Twitch cat chat shells out the dough and gets you a level 6 hype train that may get you new viewership from 3D anime women with animal ears watchers. I didn't realize we hit a level 6 hype train.
I have no idea.
Yeah, that's what happens when Matt's out of town. Matt's sick, rather. Don't find out about hype trains until it's like gone. Poggers! Poggers, let's do this again! Josh Hart's thumb. Can we keep Typhoid Emma away from the Knicks for the time being?
Oh my God.
I can't even believe somebody said that out loud.
Wuhan Emma. Wet Market Piglin. That's what we all call her.
Worse than a lab leak.
I'm a bioweapon.
Spreading more than bad ideas.
I'm a Fauci Vigland. So Fauci. Two kids in a trench coat. Sam, would you agree with Bill Maher that if you don't win an Emmy for your Bob's Burgers episode, that you are soft canceled? It has been weird. How little I've heard on social media for arguably one of the best Bob Burgers episodes ever. And I say this objectively. It's just coincidentally, I have probably one of the biggest arcs in Bob's Burgers I've had in a decade. That's a coincidence to the fact that I'm assessing it as one of the best Bob's Burgers episodes ever.
You and Todd Blanche, you guys are really able to separate.
That's the thing. Yeah, exactly. Priorities. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's absurd to in any way imply that I think that because I happen to be in it so much.
Yeah, no conflict of interest there. You're a professional.
Duh.
And I will say, in my own defense, too, I haven't even watched it. I just can tell from having performed it how good it is. Jay Tingle. Friends and acquaintances from the Caribbean have all remarked to me how lousy the bananas are in the supermarket. Cavendish bananas are the most common variety in the world, though the islands have banana varieties we don't ship that don't ship particularly well, but are very tasty. Yeah, I have no doubt, but I'm never going to get those bananas. I can't because they don't ship well. But, you know, we're a couple hours away from literally hundreds of different types of apples that you can enjoy.
I don't know what I find more charm or what I like more. Is your obsession with apples or Emma's hatred of your obsession with apples? But they both make me happy.
I don't hate it. I just am so hot right now. And I'm just wondering when the show's going to end.
It's 2:33.
We don't have any air conditioning.
She's a twice-baked apple pie.
Yeah. We're going to figure it out. But for right now, today is like the hottest day of the week, I would say, right?
So far. Tomorrow is going to be even worse.
Well, I'm not in tomorrow, so.
Thursday is going to be even, it's supposed to be 108 and no water.
Good thing the toilet's running on Thursday.
Got some bad news.
That's usually how I cool
The good
down.
News is it doesn't shut down there. Until 11, so.
Oh, that's great.
All right. I'm going to read four more of these. Mark Pinsley for PA Senate. Pennsylvania primaries have me feeling optimistic about Bob Brooks and Chris Robb's chances for their races in state Senate. Keep an eye on Pennsylvania 16th and Pennsylvania 22. Mark Pinsley in 16 and Jeff Lake in 22, both endorsed by their local DSA chapters. In state House, CC Gerlich has a good chance as well. It's super hot, so turnout's low. So I'm nervous but hopeful. Oh, geez. You know what? John from San Antonio was going to call in today.
Oh.
We didn't take calls. John, apologies.
So sorry. Make sure you tomorrow. Call in before, when is, like, June 3rd? Is that the primary?
We'll take his call tomorrow if we can.
Oh, June 2nd, yeah.
Jonathan Armstead, Adam Serwer nailed it in discussing the racial diversity of the entertainment industry in the 90s as opposed to the right-wing pushback now. As a kid, I would laugh all night watching a sitcom where a group of black variety show writers would boss around their nerdy white coworker. Elon Musk would complain about that nowadays. Anyway, jokes aside, this interview is a best-of candidate. He's mocking the show.
there was a lot of those shows, though.
What do you? No, there was not.
Well, there was a few of them. My buddy was in one.
Who?
Kyle.
What show was that?
Either Cedric the Jamie Foxx. Jamie Foxx.
Oh no, no. He was the he's the lone white guy on the Black Friday show. Yeah. Brewer and
the other way. I shouldn't have said a lot of them because the other way. Brewer, about a billion.
Yes. Brewer and Chappelle did one.
Oh yeah.
Or a show like that. I guess I don't know.
It was a Home Improvement spinoff.
Colt Dog. Sam, please post some woodworking content. All right. Two more. Michigan Mower. Sorry, I'm not a fan of Gala either. Better than Red Delicious. But Michigan does have some good apple variety, so maybe I'm just a snob. But whatever, Michigan apples, give me a break. All right, and the final IM of the day.
Don't read that top one.
Huh?
Don't read that top one. Disgusting.
Bobby V, Oregon fresh red delicious apple over all other apples. They're deep purple when they're ripe. That is just... That's blasphemy. Brian, Matt, feel better. Emma, great job today, folks. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somewhere I lost my drive,